Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you at WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois on October 2nd, 2005. Thank you very much for joining me. Today we're going to be talking about one of the central issues of the American experience of the history and present-day politics and culture of the United States, race, and we'll talk about its relationship to media, too. Joining us is going to be one of our favorite guests here on Media Matters over the past 3 years, Bob Jensen, journalism professor from the University of Texas. So join us today on Media Matters, but first, let's go to Media Minute.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
A leadership change at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting means more partisan mudslinging is likely. Controversial CPB chairman Ken Tomlinson's term ended on September 26th. He still sits on the board of directors but won't be able to pull any more stunts like hiring Republican operatives to dig dirt for a smear campaign against Bill Moyers. His replacement, however, is Cheryl Halpern. A member of the CPB board since 2002, Halpern was one of the top 100 individual donors to George W. Bush's re-election campaign. She's also a member of the Broadcasting Board of Governors, which oversees government-funded international broadcast projects. In that capacity, Halpern rabidly decried so-called liberalism within the Voice of America and went so far as to have a journalist physically removed from the studio for violating her perception of objectivity. The CPB board also has a new vice chair. She is Gay Hart Gaines. Gaines first gained prominence in Republican circles by chairing the Political Action Committee, which orchestrated a Republican takeover of Congress in 1994. Back then, Gaines worked closely on then-House Speaker Newt Gingrich's crusade to do away with public broadcasting.
Just as the leadership at the CPB veers further to the right, federal funds for public broadcasting go under the knife again. Some 100 Republicans in the House of Representatives are pushing for extraordinary spending cuts to several federal programs as a stopgap measure to cover costs associated with Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. One of their proposals calls for defunding all of public broadcasting immediately. This comes as public broadcasters in areas affected by the hurricanes continue to rebuild both themselves and the communities they serve. Public radio and TV stations are active in shelters for the displaced, working to connect people with job and housing placement services and handing out free books to kids.
The makers of TiVo call it an unfortunate bug, but the personal video recorder now gives content makers the capability to lock down any recorded program and restrict how long users can view them, even to the point of automatically deleting them if necessary. Such prohibitions, according to TiVo, are supposed to be restricted to pay-per-view type programs and other premium TV services, but some TiVo users report the copy protection showed up recently on some traditional over-the-air broadcast fare. Not all digital video recorders contain copy protection features. For example, the Electronic Frontier Foundation provides a manual online that teaches you step-by-step how to build and program an open-source PVR. In related news, the recording and motion picture industries are circulating talking points in Washington in support of legislation requiring digital TV and radio broadcasts be protected with copy protection technology. The FCC has already tried to force TV manufacturers to include copy protection in HDTV sets, but that's been struck down in court.
When local governments consider offering broadband internet access as a public utility, phone and cable companies aggressively lobby against such projects. But the tables are turned in Cleveland Heights, Ohio, where city officials are thinking of commandeering a fiber optic network initially built by the now bankrupt cable company Adelphia. The network currently links public buildings and schools, and the city would like to extend its reach by adding public wireless access points. However, Adelphia refuses to provide the city with necessary technical information to move ahead with network expansion. Eminent domain may be the only option left.
Disney deputizes Verizon to be on guard against illicit file sharing. In exchange for permission to carry a dozen Disney cable channels on its new fiber optic broadband network, Disney will keep watch on Verizon broadband customers and report any suspicious uploading and downloading it finds. Verizon will then contact tagged customers and ask them for a response to Disney's allegation. Unsatisfactory answers could result in immediate termination of broadband service. However, neither Verizon nor Disney have explained what the burden of proof will be in these cases, and while both parties have pledged to keep customer information confidential, there is no specific mechanism by which that is guaranteed.
When it comes to pundits pushing government propaganda, Armstrong Williams appears to be just the tip of the iceberg. Williams was paid $250,000 to push the No Child Left Behind Act in newspaper columns and on television. But a recently released report, sparked by the Williams disclosure, notes that the U.S. Department of Education spent more than $12 million to generate positive coverage of the law. This includes some $5 million, which went toward publicity efforts that lacked appropriate disclosure about the government's involvement. Of that, $2 million went to PR firms and other consultants for which there is no record of any actual work being done.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. We've got a show today, I think, that will be unusual for Media Matters, covering a topic we've only alluded to occasionally on past shows. And we've got a guest, though, who is known to most of our regular listeners, Bob Jensen, journalism professor from the University of Texas, author of many books, including Citizens of the Empire, and a new book, The Heart of Whiteness, Confronting Race, Racism, and White Privilege. Bob Jensen is a common writer across the internet and in progressive media of media criticism on U.S. foreign policy, matters of race and gender, and it is a privilege to welcome Bob Jensen to Media Matters today. Bob, welcome.
Always good to be with you, Bob.
Bob, for starters, why don't you talk a little bit about the new book, The Heart of Whiteness? You know, this is a term we've talked about a little bit on Media Matters in the past, and I think it is a term that is known on the fringes of sort of political culture and intellectual culture, but it hasn't really exploded yet into the popular consciousness yet, the term whiteness. What do you mean by the heart of whiteness, and why did you write this book?
Well, the title is a playoff, of course, Conrad's The Heart of Darkness. And traditionally in the United States, we've always talked about race in terms of non-white populations, the problem of the black population or indigenous people or something. And the whole point of marking whiteness as part of the racial discourse is to, from my point of view, to identify whiteness as the problem. That is, the ideology and practice of white supremacy is the racial problem we have in this country. We don't have a black problem. We don't have a Latino problem. We don't have an indigenous problem. We have a white problem. That is to say, we're a white supremacist culture in both our history and our contemporary practice. And the goal in writing the book was to focus on that. I happen to be white, and I think one of the political obligations of white people is to start realizing this, articulating it, and trying to get our way out of it.
Well, you know, a common refrain that one hears today is that, okay, sure, there has been slavery in American history. That was a bad thing. And, you know, there was Jim Crow, and that was a bad thing, too. But, you know, we had the Civil Rights Movement. Now we've, you know, formal legal equality. Now it's really up to individuals to do what they want to do. There's no longer any formal segregation. There's affirmative action programs to help people, African Americans and people of color, to get into schools they might not get into otherwise. You know, this is all passé. What is the case you're making about this problem today?
Well, first of all, we can look at the material realities of life in the United States. If, in fact, we were an equal society with a level playing field, we might ask why are racialized disparities in measures of wealth and well-being, access to resources and health, that sort of thing, why are they so dramatically unequal? And, in fact, not only why are they unequal, but why is the gap between, for instance, white and black America in many ways wider today than it was when the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts were passed? That is, if you look at some of these measures, and in the book I summarize some of these that a very good group, United for a Fair Economy, put together. In some measures of wealth, for instance, black America is further behind white America today than it was 40 years ago. Well, what are the possible explanations for that? It strikes me that one would first, before anything else, look at a white supremacist society and locate the problem not in the failure of individuals, but in the nature of the system. And in fact, if we want to be honest and look at it, we can see the way in which white supremacist notions remain very deeply embedded in American culture, both ideologically, in the sense that we still often implicitly talk about Northern European white culture as superior, and also in the material realities. Well, I think if one wants to be honest, and you know, I'm a big believer in being honest politically, you start with that recognition and then try to ask, how can those of us who have that privilege of being white in a white society, white supremacist society, what are our moral and political obligations to try and start to change the structure of that society?
How does this white supremacy play itself out? I mean, do people in power, I mean, how does it manifest itself in our institutions and day-to-day life, if not through, like, people just being blatantly racist, you know, and telling sure. racist jokes and, you know, saying, I think I'm not going to hire blacks. Blacks are inferior.
Yeah. Well, there's two things. One is, of course, that kind of overt discrimination still exists. It doesn't exist in public, for the most part, and it doesn't exist in polite society, because we all know that we're not supposed to have those ideas. Yet everybody understands perfectly well that it still is a reality. But you make a good point that if you take a look at the Bush administration, you know, as conservative, you know, right-wing reactionary an administration as you can imagine, and yet its cabinet is, you know, full of non-white folks. Some of its, you know, stars, Condi Rice, Colin Powell, African American, of course. And what that tells us is people in power have accepted the sort of reality of a multiracial society. But the promise of the civil rights movement, of the black power movement, in other words, some of the political motivation behind those movements to bring equality were not just about putting a few non-white faces in positions of power. It was about fundamentally changing the rules by which society went forward to produce a more just and equitable distribution of wealth and power. That's what we haven't achieved yet. So George Bush can, you know, talk about his great advances in civil rights by appointing these folks, and in some sense we shouldn't trivialize that. The fact that you can have a Secretary of State today who is of African descent, whereas that would have been unimaginable 50 years ago, is an improvement. It's a move forward. But it doesn't mean that the struggle is over. Remember, especially, I mean, take the ultimate icon of the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King Jr., who's now been accepted as a great hero in American political history. Well, Martin Luther King Jr. wasn't just talking about, let's have a black Secretary of State. He was talking about, at the end of his life, let's end militarism and U.S. imperialism. Let's create a more fundamentally fair economy in which people all throughout society have access to the resources they need for a minimally decent life. And let's keep our eye on racism. Well, that notion of civil rights as an all-encompassing kind of liberatory system has been successfully derailed by people like George Bush, and for that matter, by lots of liberals as well, who are no more interested in changing the fundamental distribution of wealth and power in this country than are the conservatives.
We're talking to Bob Jensen today, Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you on WILL AM 580. Bob Jensen, a frequent guest of ours here in Media Matters, is the author of the brand-new book, The Heart of Whiteness, Confronting Race, Racism, and White Privilege. It's just a newly released book. And the publisher is, who's your publisher? City Lights is the publisher. Jensen's the author of many articles and books, including what the great book, Citizens of the Empire, which you were on discussing last year with us, and is a professor of journalism at the University of Texas. We recorded this show about a week before going on air, so please don't call in today. Sit back, relax, let Bob Jensen and me do the yakking, because that's what we like to do the most. And we'll take over from here. Bob, you were just talking about racism, white supremacy, and liberals. Sort of the catch understanding of how race plays out in the United States is that liberals are not racist and they're against racism, and conservatives, you know, are less sensitive, if not exactly racist. You don't buy that characterization, I take it.
No, I think that's far too simplistic. First of all, we should recognize that liberal, conservative, you know, fascist or communist, whatever, if we are white in this society, we have what has commonly come to be called now white privilege. That is, independent of our own personal views about how race relations should go, how the economy should be structured, whatever, to be white is to have access to privilege in this society. And so in that sense, none of us are off the hook. And in the book, I try to avoid that kind of finger-pointing and saying, oh, well, here's a class of white people who are okay because we don't tell racist jokes anymore, and we believe in affirmative action, and you know, whatever markers we believe make us not racist anymore. In fact, the book has several quite painful recollections on my own part of my own failures, and those are not just failures, you know, 20 years ago. It's failures within, painfully, I have to admit, within the past year. In other words, to be white is to be in a position of privilege and also to be in a position of ignorance in some sense. That is, when you're white, you have to constantly struggle to understand the nature of white supremacy and to extract yourself from it to the degree you can. So it's not only that, you know, I don't just blame the conservatives. It's that I don't blame everybody else and try to hold myself out from that. You know, I was raised in a white society. Actually, I come from North Dakota, which is, you know, an extremely white part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
I'm about as white as it gets in the United States. And so I have my own history, my own lingering socialization that I struggle with. And I think that's the first step for white people is instead of, you know, pointing at either a system which is bigger than any one of us, which does in fact exist, but rather than pointing at that or pointing at people within that system who are obviously, you know, overtly racist, I think it's better that we spend some time doing what is not always fun, which is, of course, looking in the mirror and telling the truth about ourselves.
You know, there's the famous section, Bob Jensen, in, excuse me, the autobiography of Malcolm X, where he writes, I think he was at Harvard or some university, in the 1960s giving a speech, and a white woman mm-hmm. comes up to him and says, "Mr. X, I agree with everything you're saying. I feel terrible about what my people have done to your people. You know, what can I do to help the cause?" And he answers, "Nothing." You know, like basically, it's our business, not yours. You're the problem. What would you say to that? If you gave a speech and that woman's daughter came up to you today, what would you tell her?
Well, first of all, I think Malcolm X later, you know, kind of qualified that answer and said, of course, there is always a place in any struggle for allies from the dominant class, from the dominant culture, and certainly that's the case. You know, if you look at any of these, you know, basic questions of oppression, whether it's gender, race, you know, life in a capitalist economy, liberatory movements that have started from below, from oppressed people, have always counted on allies from the dominant culture, and there's lots we can do. In this case, I think there's something fundamental in recognizing, if you are white, that white is the problem. I think that's the first step one has to make, that it's not a question of being white and asking, how can I help these poor black folk, or how can I help Latinos, or how can I, from my position of benevolence, you know, out of my nobility, help people. I think the question is, how do I work within my own community, that is white society, to try and highlight some of these realities and start to build a political movement that can aid those other folk who are trying to combat white supremacy. So I think the same thing applies to men who want to work in feminism or people from the middle class who want to work, you know, to end the inherent exploitation in capitalism. It's also true of Americans, U.S. citizens, who want to work to end U.S. imperialism abroad. It's not that we define the agenda, we decide what needs to be done. It's that we recognize that from a position of privilege, we can try to undermine that privilege in alliance and solidarity with people from groups that are, of course, victimized by those dominant systems.
We're talking to Bob Jensen today on Media Matters. This is a pre-recorded show, so sit back, relax, and let us do the talking. We're talking about Jensen's new book, The Heart of Whiteness, Confronting Race, Racism, and White Privilege, here in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a new book just out from City Lights Book. Jensen's also the author of Citizens of the Empire and a professor at the University of Texas in the Journalism School and a frequent guest of ours here on Media Matters. Bob, just a few weeks ago, Hurricane Katrina ravaged the Gulf Coast of the United States and got massive media attention, as did the sort of failed effort to get people out of there. And it sort of drew attention to poverty and issues of race and class in our media, news media, in a way that really hadn't been present in a very long time. What was your take on that?
Well, I think, as you point out, it was kind of unavoidable to understand that poverty had an effect on who got out and who didn't, who suffered and who escaped suffering as a result of Katrina. It was hard to ignore that, yet, of course, many people did ignore that. And in fact, I wrote a bit about this and got amazing mail from white people saying, well, poor because they're lazy, they don't work, therefore all of this is, you know, an individual failure. So even though there was increased discussion and people, I think, struggling with this, we should remember that a big chunk of America, white America, took this as evidence of their own superiority, number one. But of course, you know, at least in the media, journalists were talking about this, and in fact many people were pleasantly surprised that journalists were willing to take up what are usually kind of topics that they avoid, which is the nature of poverty and the nature of the racial character of poverty. At the same time, we saw on TV evidence of just how much this country remains a white supremacist culture. I think probably the most famous one these days is Wolf Blitzer, who's an alleged journalist on CNN. You may have heard of him.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, well, Wolf, you know, he was narrating some film from New Orleans, and he said, you know, our correspondent had just pointed out how desperate the situation is. These people are so desperate. They're so poor, and they're so black, he said. Now, I don't want to just make fun of Wolf Blitzer. He's kind of a caricature himself, but and I'm not even sure what he meant by that. God knows what was going on in his head. But I think that does tell you a bit about how much of white America still marks blackness as not just a skin tone, but as almost a metaphysical condition, which carries with it, of course, all sorts of negatives. So I think in Katrina we see both the best of this political instinct to challenge white supremacy, including from many people within white society, but we also see the worst of it, the way in which, rather than confront it, people revert to a kind of individualized explanation for social problems. All social problems are the result of the failure of those people who just happen to be poor, happen to be downtrodden.
Paul Krugman in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago had a column, I don't know if you saw it, Bob, I think it carried online in a number of places, presenting a thesis which is actually not uncommon and has been known in historical circles for a long time, the idea that white racism is a singular factor to account for the lack of having social democracy in the United States, that the unwillingness of whites to pay for social programs that might benefit blacks undermines the ability of whites to pay for programs that would benefit themselves if they were working class whites. And so the United States, singularly of the advanced industrial countries, doesn't have health insurance, has a woeful welfare system, doesn't have great unemployment insurance, has weak unions. Did you see that column?
Yeah, I'm a little skeptical just by nature of sort of simple explanations for complex historical developments. I mean, certainly there are a lot of reasons the United States has developed very differently than Europe in these matters. The degree to which, you know, just outright force and violence were used to crush unions long before these kind of racial issues, I think, were at the forefront, has something to do with it. There's a kind of unique hostility on the part of the business community in the United States over time to any conception of worker rights, for instance. Now, that's obviously part of the story, too. Can we reduce that to an explanation of based on race? I'm rather skeptical. I'm not a historian and don't pretend to bring, you know, long study to this.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly the degree to which people in power, which of course has been a white power structure, have created wedges around race is certainly well documented. Certainly from the founding of this country on, the fear, for instance, that poor whites, indentured servants, and those folks would see their natural class interests as being allied with slaves of African descent or indigenous people or others who were getting kicked around. Certainly there was conscious discussion and thought given to that among the white power structure, and there were strategies employed. And certainly, you know, in the union movement, for instance, the use of the racial wedge to try and get white people to think their interests lay with, you know, connecting to the white power structure rather than bonding with other oppressed groups. I mean, that's all part of our history, too.
Well, Bob, let's talk a little bit more about media, if we can, before
sure.
we get back to your book, because the question of race and media has sort of been a subplot of media analysis for some time, both on the left and right. A book came out a few years ago, and the author's name escapes me off the top of my head, but it got a lot of attention by a conservative author who argued basically that the news media were soft on being critical of the African-American leadership and the African-American community for fear of being seen as racist. And therefore, the Jesse Jacksons and Al Sharptons and basically the entire black leadership has sort of got a free pass from our news media and critical, hard analysis of racial issues that might reflect unfavorably on African-Americans were sort of glossed over because of the liberal bias of the news media. And, you know, I'd be interested in, you know, I could imagine what your response would be to that. So I'd like to hear that. But I'd also want to hear the other side of the coin, which I think is probably one you're more in your comfort zone, if I can make such a presumption, which is your research that shows that in the coverage of welfare issues in the United States historically over the last 30 years, that coverage that regards welfare as an issue that goes basically to people down on their luck having a hard time who are almost always white, it tends to be covered in a very favorable manner. It's like, yeah, these people really need help. Mm-hmm. And when it's people of color, specifically African-Americans, the tone tends to be much less charitable. And the research has sort of confirmed this conclusively. That's not really a debatable issue. What's your sense of media and race, using that as a preface, and go anywhere you want with your answer?
Well, I think let's go back to the question of does the liberal media sometimes back away from tough coverage of racial issues? I think there's more than a kernel of truth in that. And here I'm using liberal in the disparaging mode. Of course, in this culture, anytime we talk about liberal, we have to be clear about what we mean, because if you have a binary, liberal and conservative, and you're either one or the other, then I'm a liberal, I suppose. But if you start looking at the political spectrum more broadly, and you can distinguish between, you know, conservatives and reactionaries and liberals and leftists, then I think some of the critique of the liberal media is actually on target. That is, in some ways, the media are liberal. They're not liberal in terms of their position on the economy or on basic foreign policy questions. The research there shows that journalists, everything from working journalists up, tend to be to the right of the public. But on social issues, working journalists do tend to be on the liberal side of the fence on things like gay rights and women's rights and that sort of thing. Now, I don't want to limit the analysis just to working journalists, but if we're going to talk at that level, I think a lot of white liberals, and I see this not only in journalism but in the academy, in universities, are a little nervous around the question about race. They're a little nervous about being tagged as racist themselves, and I think sometimes they do step back from an honest engagement on subjects like this out of a fear of being targeted. Now, I don't blame the black community or non-white political movements. I think that's a failure of white liberals. But certainly, take Jesse Jackson, for instance. Jesse Jackson is a complex political figure who has been at the forefront of some movements, an important political figure in many ways, but also a person I think should be open to criticism. Certainly within the black community, there's a lot of people who are not shy about criticizing Jesse Jackson and the way he has ridden his own personal prestige and visibility to not the benefit of a movement, but the benefit of himself. And that criticism is appropriate, and I think it's justifiable, and one hears it in all sorts of ways. So, you know, a lot of this is very complex, and critiques of liberals in this sense have a kernel of truth to them, but they also have to be seen in the bigger context of how there's kind of a relentless hostility, especially to African Americans, but to non-white communities more generally in the media. There's a long tradition of stereotypical representations, whether it's in news or in entertainment media. That's been documented. The effect of that on the image of non-white people in white minds, the effect of that on non-white people themselves has been, you know, well documented. And it's that bigger context, of course, we always have to keep in mind. Of that, one example is the one you detailed very clearly, and I agree with, that welfare is often, you know, a two-sided coin depending on the color of the person receiving the welfare. Of course, remember the way in which political leaders have used that, Ronald Reagan's famous sort of use of the rhetoric around welfare queens, which were implicitly black, for instance. You know, the idea that women, black women who get welfare, you know, are all driving around in Cadillacs, you know, a distortion of reality that's sort of off the charts. And that reminds us of something even, I think, more central, which is if you think about groups of people who have worked historically in this culture, is there any group other than African Americans whose labor has been more exploited, who have worked harder for less historically than black Americans? I mean, it's hard to even imagine. Yet it's very funny that they've become the symbol of laziness. And the media is part of that. Very cynical political leaders are part of that. And in some sense, all of white America is responsible for that, for refusing to challenge it on a regular basis.
We're talking to Bob Jensen today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. This is a pre-recorded show. We taped it a week or so before going on air, so please don't call in today to sit back and listen. Bob Jensen is the author of the brand new book, The Heart of Whiteness, Confronting Race, Racism, and White Privilege, just published by City Lights Book. Jensen also wrote Citizens of the Empire. He's a professor of media ethics and journalism at the University of Texas, and he has been he is a frequent guest on all sorts of media, television, Fox News, MSNBC, and he's one of our frequent guests. I think, Bob, except for John Nichols, you win the award as our most frequent guest in the three-year history of Media Matters. It's a privilege to have you on with us.
Do I get free upgrades to first-class seats then?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
And you're even allowed to use the bathroom.
Oh, great.
So, you know, we're talking about race and racism and media in our society today. And your book, I mean, I think what your book does, it's quite striking, is you get right into your own, as you've already mentioned, you get right at your own personal experience. I mean, confronting the fact that white privilege isn't something people assume. It's so deeply embedded into our society. It's something that even people who are of the highest principle and who are anti-racist can't escape it. I mean, talk about your personal experiences and how that plays out with you, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, it's not the easiest thing to talk about because, you know, when we do look in the mirror honestly, it often is rather painful. I go back in the book and talk about growing up partly in an all-white society and what that does. I look at a couple of incidences in my 20s, for instance, about 20 years ago, when without really thinking very much about it, I bought into the kind of affirmative action backlash. The assumption in an affirmative action program, for instance, that anyone who isn't white is there basically undeservingly. Mm-hmm. And I look back at a period when I was working in newsrooms and am just sort of appalled at my own behavior, at the assumptions I didn't challenge, and what that meant, not just in my own head, but what that meant in the way I acted towards, in this case, a black coworker. And, you know, that's sort of safely in the past. That was 20 years ago. It's easier to think about. But I really, you know, got caught short once in the last couple of years where I found myself, without thinking again, very unthinkingly, making assumptions about my own superiority in relationship, in this case, to an African-American who I was on a panel with as a speaker, and being confronted with that. And I will say it was kind of devastating. You know, when you're 46, I think I was at the time, and you're an appropriately, you know, hip, liberal, radical academic who's read all the right books and thought all the right thoughts, you want to think that you've passed certain barriers. And that was like running into a brick wall. And, you know, I think, most of us who are white, unless we were raised in a very idiosyncratic way or have somehow, you know, transcended race, most of us can point to situations, and if we're honest, think about those situations and see those lingering effects of our own training and the way in which, again, without thinking, we fall into those patterns. And I don't know any way out of the trap except to confront ourselves and confront each other. I start the book with another very painful story about a discussion I had with a friend about a racist joke. That's also part of the process, not just, you know, by ourselves reflecting on our own experience, but being willing to engage with other white people to try and challenge each other. And the book is full of that because I don't think I could have written a book about race without bringing those things into it.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think I certainly can share your experiences in my own life, too. But at the same time, knowing you, where you're coming from, and knowing what you've written in your career, Bob, and what you stand for, when you see race, you're talking about a political process, too, of inequality and injustice, and that requires mm-hmm. political solutions. Once you've sort of gone through sort of looking in the mirror and really being hard on yourself and talking to your friends, what is the way out of this beyond, you know, that gets you so far.
Yeah.
And eventually that's going to sort of peter out if it
sure.
doesn't let, you know, go somewhere else. What's the next stage after that?
Well, absolutely. And in fact, there's a chapter in the book called Against Diversity for Politics. and obviously I'm not arguing against a diverse society or against a multicultural world, but saying exactly, I think, what you're getting at, that if we end with just personal self-reflection and try to increase our own appreciation of diversity and, you know, be more decent people in our own daily lives, that's certainly important. It's, in fact, necessary to political progress. But I agree that nothing substantive will change until there is political change. That means changes in systems and institutions. And that's a political project. Now, I think a lot of people wonder, well, how is that going to happen? And they look for kind of a magic bullet. What's the anti-racist political project that will change the world? And I think that's really not adequate to the task. There are questions that are, you know, specifically racial and racialized that we do have to address. I mean, take just the question of law enforcement. In every city I've ever been in or ever know about, there are concerns in non-white communities about disparities in how law enforcement treat different populations. The question of police brutality in black communities, the question of people of color being stopped for, you know, simply driving, you know, the concept of driving while black or driving while brown. Well, that's a specifically racial problem, and that's a political project everybody can contribute to, non-white and white alike. At the same time, you know, race politics plays out in other political movements as well. I mean, take the union movement, for instance. At one point, unions were, you know, a hotbed of racism, and that has changed over time. There's still a lot of work to do to make sure unions are truly open and are part of a struggle for racial justice. Well, one can be a union member, a union activist, and engage in anti-racist politics just within the context of your own labor movement. One doesn't have to go off and be an anti-racist crusader to do anti-racist work within other political movements. I do a lot of anti-war work, and certainly those of us in that movement have long been aware that it's a predominantly white movement in which the goals and objectives get defined by white people, yet it has to broaden out. And so we struggle, and that's a movement that's been, I think, particularly ineffective in that struggle, and there's a lot of work to be done. You know, every other movement for social justice, feminism, the environmental movement, has struggled with this, and people who are predominantly rooted in those movements can be part of it. Take the environmental movement, which has actually an overtly racist streak in it when people start talking about population control in the U.S., for instance, and start talking about how immigration has to be limited because we don't want those brown people coming over the borders. And, you know, there's a whole lot of work to do in every social justice movement that exists on the question of race, just as there is on the question of gender. I mean, this is where we start to see, I think, a holistic politics developing. And I think that's important because people can make contributions, white people can make contributions, no matter what, you know, kind of movement they're in, no matter what their primary political affiliation is. Certainly, you know, you're familiar with this in the media reform movement. There's clearly a racial component, a question of racial justice in the question of media reform, and it's being raised and it's being debated. It's not always easy. It produces conflict, and our task is to try and work through that.
Bob Jensen, you know, I was once doing historical work many years ago in the National Archives, and I came across a memo from the 1940s in the State Department papers where they were, I forget the context of the memo entirely, but the gist of the memo was the State Department's reporting on sentiment of leaders in Latin America. And in passing, they made a reference that the people in Latin America, the leaders down there, all considered the United States a white country. They didn't even regard it as being anything but a white country. That was their assumption when they talked about it, similar to a European country. And you talk about the sort of equation, or the equation of whiteness with sort of Americanness in your book. I want you to talk about that too, but I also want you to layer that, if you can, in your answer with the discussion of what clearly is a radical transformation of the racial geography of the United States that's going on right now. We're in the middle of, I don't know if we're in the middle, we're in the process, where we are, who knows, with the influx of immigrants from Asia, from Latin America, such that at some point in the future, I don't know when, white people, as they're called, will probably be numerically a minority in this country. What's your sense, first of that, could you answer both those parts?
Sure.
And I don't really know the answer to either, to the second one. I'm interested in your take on it.
Well, you know, I live in a state, Texas, that is now at the tipping point of being what we call a majority-minority state. That is, non-white people are no longer the majority, or excuse me, white people are no longer the majority. And that demographic trend is unstoppable. And you can see just how scared people get by that, by the discussion around immigration. So, for instance, there was an important piece, I think, in the journal Foreign Policy, you know, very important mainstream establishment journal, by Samuel Huntington, who many people recognize as one of the sometimes silliest spokespersons for the establishment, but certainly somebody who's taken seriously as a Harvard government professor. And he's arguing not that, you know, immigration in and of itself is bad, but immigration is bad if people of Hispanic origins, people who primarily see their culture rooted in a Spanish-speaking world, for instance, if they don't assimilate into English-speaking Northern European culture, he's actually arguing that America, the United States, will remain as a country in some formal sense, but it will lose its Americanness if that cultural transformation takes place. Well, that's about as close as you get to open racism, you know, in polite society, saying, listen, the United States is fundamentally a white country. That is, its cultural history, what makes it special is that it comes out of white Northern Europe, and it's an implicit argument that there's something special about people who come from that part of the world. That's what I think we mean when we say America is a white country. Not demographically is it always going to remain a majority white country, but that in the eyes of many people, and most importantly, the people who tend to run the country, it's defined as coming out of that historical situation.
Yeah, if I can interject. I mean, along those lines, the argument would be that the Eastern Europeans, the Irish, the Southern Europeans, who were considered outsiders until 100 years ago, have been effectively assimilated. Now they are full white brothers and sisters.
Right. And, of course, there are two groups that the United States, well, there are many groups the United States has trouble with, but let's talk about two or three in particular. One is, of course, this generic Hispanic term, Latino, whatever term you want to use. And the distinction there is about language and culture, and that scares white America because it doesn't know how to be a multilingual society. It's never been that, and it's never been a truly multicultural society in the sense of equally valuing all cultures. It's a multicultural society in the sense that it allows multiple cultures to exist, but we're talking, of course, about what's given primacy and what defines the country. The other population group that I think the United States is always going to struggle with, at least in my lifetime, is people of African descent. What do you do with a formerly enslaved people who, for the vast majority of the history of this country, were defined as less than? How do you make that transition? And I think, you know, we don't want to reduce the question of race to just black and white, but I think we also have to acknowledge there's something very distinctive about the black-white divide in the United States, and that's something we have to wrestle with. Of course, one of the other, you know, central questions is probably the racial group that has suffered the most in the sense that they were almost completely exterminated are indigenous people. And the United States has never really been able, white America has never been able to come to terms with the state of indigenous America simply because I think the historical guilt is so overwhelming. I mean, how do you make sense of the injustice done when that injustice was at the level of genocide? I mean, these are not easy things to cross. On the other hand, you can see that, as you point out, people from Eastern Europe, people from Southern Europe, were eventually assimilated into white society. There's a famous book, How the Irish Became White, for instance. How even Jewish Americans became white in that sense, despite the fact they were once, you know, highly sort of targeted, demonized in all sorts of ways. The question is, can a Spanish-speaking population, can a formerly enslaved population, can an indigenous population be assimilated like that if America is going to hold on to its conception of itself as white? I have my doubts. I think it's a fundamental breaking point in the history of this country. Either we cope with that and we at least create the possibility of going forward in a civilized manner, or we fail at it, in which case I don't think there's really much possible for this country.
Bob Jensen, our guest today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, come to you on WILL AM 580. We've got about 15 minutes or so left on the show. This is a pre-recorded show, so please do not try to call in today. Bob Jensen, our guest, is the author of the brand new book, The Heart of Whiteness, Confronting Race, Racism, and White Privilege. We've been talking about that book and the issue of race and racism and white supremacy today on the program. Jensen is a professor of journalism at the University of Texas, a frequent guest on our show, and also the author of a book we've discussed on this program in the past, Citizens of the Empire. It's a privilege, as always, to have you on with us today, Bob Jensen. Bob, I mean, race is a complex issue, obviously, when you talk about the Hispanic or Latino, the Asian population, the Native Indigenous population, and the African American population. It's not just black and white, literally. What about race and class? How do those two sort of fundamental concepts relate? And in our culture, and how do you see them playing out?
Well, we've talked already about the way in which race was used by the dominant class, the ruling class, the property class, whatever term you want to use. The way in which race has been used over time to keep poor white folks from seeing natural alliances with other groups. So that's sort of woven into the fabric of U.S. history, and it doesn't get unwoven immediately, of course. We also see that poverty, that there's a correlation, quite a strong correlation between race and class in that sense, that black America, brown America continues to be economically underprivileged relative to white America. Poverty rates nearly double the norm, and in fact triple the white poverty rate. Unemployment rates double the norm. So we see the connection, the racialized nature of class in this culture as well. To me, the lesson one takes away from that is that one doesn't pursue individualized solutions to social problems. One doesn't say, okay, we've got a race problem. Maybe there's a problem with the way capitalism distributes wealth, but we'll deal with that later. Let's deal with the race problem now. It strikes me that, again, to harken back to Martin Luther King Jr., who at the end of his life, as his politics matured and his analysis deepened and his strategy expanded, started to look at the need to build a poor people's movement that incorporated poor whites and as well as non-white people. It seems to me that's the only route we can go. It's not easy to figure out how to do that, but certainly it seems to me it should be our focus.
Bob Jensen, what do you think in terms of our mainstream media? What could be done to make the media more sensitive or journalists more sensitive to issues of race and white supremacy? Is there any way we could work on that level? Any hope in that area?
Well, there's as much hope as there is on any other difficult political struggle, I suppose. I mean, if one wants to be honest about the place we find ourselves in 2005, whatever the issue you want to take, the ecological crisis, the state of gender relations and levels of sexual violence that continue, the enduring realities of white supremacy, the growing inequality in capitalism, both internally in the U.S. as well as internationally. I mean, if you look at any of those, Bob, it's not a happy time. We've made progress in all sorts of ways. Formal freedoms have expanded. Opportunities in many ways for people have expanded, yet we find ourselves still stuck in these, fundamental disparities. Well, is there any hope? Well, of course there's hope in the sense that history always teaches us that even in periods of political retrenchment, when progressive values are being, beaten back, that people who continue on struggling, continue to maintain decent progressive values and pursue them, can form the basis from which future political victories then go forward. That's just one of the lessons of history. I think a lot depends now on people. We live in a very affluent country, and I think a lot depends on people in positions of privilege and comfort taking up what are essentially movements that might be seen as against their short-term self-interest. That is, if take the anti-war movement or the anti-empire movement. If you're an affluent middle-class person in the United States, you can make an argument that U.S. domination of the world is in your interest. It protects your material privilege and comfort. But, of course, I think that's a very short-term kind of calculation. The same for white folks. You can see that white supremacy protects you. It gives you privilege. But, again, I think that's a very short-term calculation. I think for two reasons we should continue to struggle. One is that that's how we become better people. You really deepen your own humanity, I think, when you struggle for justice. And that's a benefit to all of us. And the other thing is to realize that the system we're in is simply unsustainable. That is, the short-term material benefits we get from it literally cannot be sustained over time. I mean, we see that now most dramatically, ecologically, that if we don't fundamentally shift the values on which this system is based, we're all, you know, heading for the cliff. Now, when we're going to go over that cliff, nobody can guess. You know, history doesn't give us the tools to make that kind of determination. But those are the kinds of things I would say to people to try and motivate them to work for social justice, even if they do find themselves in positions of privilege. There's both a self-interest in it. It's the way you deepen and enrich your own life. And it also is the only way we can imagine staving off, you know, I hate to talk in apocalyptic terms. You know, maybe I start to sound like somebody who's been reading the Book of Revelations too much. But it is now possible to see, not so far ahead, really dramatic and potentially cataclysmic kind of shifts in not only in the United States but worldwide that are going to be quite dramatic.
Bob Jensen, you teach at the University of Texas, which, like the University of Illinois, is a major public research university with an undergraduate body that largely comes from the middle or upper middle class.
Mm-hmm.
People coming from the affluent middle class homes, precisely what you've been talking about. When you're teaching students on issues like this, what sort of response do you get?
Well, not surprisingly, you get a range of responses. Although UT does still predominantly serve kind of the gentry of Texas, there have been successful efforts made to diversify this student body, both in terms, I think, of income and in terms of race and ethnicity. So I end up in classrooms with a wide variety of students. I can have students from the rich suburbs of Houston and Dallas who've known privilege their entire lives. And I can have students from the Rio Grande Valley who are first-generation college students of Mexican-American background with parents who don't speak English. Well, that's a huge divide. When it works the best in the classroom, people are teaching each other. That is, some of those students who come from less privileged backgrounds can do an amazing job, not necessarily by taking on the role of teacher, but just by talking honestly and reflecting about the material in class. That's when it works the best. When it fails, and we've all had failures as teachers, of course, it's when you can't break that privilege, when people are so secure and, quite frankly, smug. I get students who strike me as very self-satisfied because they've been told their whole life that they're special and that the reason they're at UT is because they're smart, and the reason they're smart is because they're either, I don't know, just genetically endowed that way or they work so hard. And they're never taught to see the way privilege operates. They're never taught to see the fact that they grew up in a household with lots of books around and tutors and private high schools and all of the access to all of the best resources. Well, when you've never been taught how to see that privilege, and in a sense it's not surprising that it's invisible to you. And part of what one does as a teacher then is to try and make that visible. And that means that one of the, I think, fundamental jobs, those of us who teach students like that, is to make them uncomfortable, is to open their eyes to something they had previously not thought of. And that kind of goes against the grain for teachers. A lot of us who teach, you know, want to help students, and it's always kind of an interesting position to recognize that the best way you can help students is to make them miserable. That is, to raise these issues which will cause them some amount of distress. But, of course, distress is also a sign of growth and learning and maturity. So I think that's what I strive for, is to sometimes destabilize students' conception of the world. And when it's successful, sometimes you make them miserable.
Do you find there's a difference in the way non-white students respond to what your teaching method is to white students, or is it similar?
No, absolutely. I was in a class where we were discussing the aftermath of Katrina, for instance, and one of these almost caricatured privileged white students said, you know, I was watching TV and they were talking about how race affected the rescue and search missions of Katrina. And she said, it just seemed like such a radical notion. I can't understand what they mean by that. And it was the ultimate sort of naive white view of the world. And before I could even imagine responding, there were a half a dozen students who were in the discussion saying, well, you have to look at this and you have to consider this. Some of those were non-white students. Some of them, I was happy to see, were also white students who'd thought through the question. So the presence of a more diverse student body is very important. It's very important just for the future of the country, of course. But it's also a real gift to white students. I think that's one of the unfortunate parts of the backlash to affirmative action, is that white people don't realize that diversifying what was previously a very narrow and privileged group, so such as University of Texas students, is an amazing gift to them if they could only see that and make use of it.
That argument also, I assume, holds to newsrooms and faculties, that more diversity there is a gift to everyone.
Sure. But we have to remember that it's not just diversity of persons. It's not just a question of putting a few non-white faces in a newsroom. There also has to be a commitment on the part of the institution, whether it's a newspaper or whether it's a university. There has to be a commitment to bring in what that diversity can mean. For instance, there's a very good book on this by Pamela Newkirk, an NYU professor of journalism, called Within the Veil, where she makes the point that simply diversifying newsrooms by adding people of color, when you don't at least be open to the notion that the white cultural values that structure the newsroom might shift, you know, all you're doing is sort of, you know, adding a little flavor to what is essentially an unchangeable institution. And she points out that one of the reasons non-white journalists leave the profession at a higher rate than white journalists is they're recruited to go into this institution, but then not allowed to bring the experience that they have to bear on changing the institution. So it's not just a question of you know, do you hire a more colorful mix? The question is the institution itself open to change? And unfortunately, you know, I've worked my entire adult life either in newsrooms or in universities, and I see a lot of resistance to that. I see a lot of a kind of nominal acceptance of the need to diversify in hiring, but I don't see a concomitant sort of commitment to diversifying the underlying structure of the university.
What media do you use to cover issues of race and white supremacy? Are there media that you look to that cover this issue well that you recommend to our listeners?
Well, certainly within mainstream news media, because of these attempts to diversify, there are good journalists, non-white journalists, working in the mainstream. Just to give an example I'm familiar with, Les Payne, a top editor at Newsday, has had a distinguished career as a reporter. And he has brought to bear, I think, his experience as an African-American and as someone who grew up in the segregated South also. And I think his journalism reflects that. It's much richer and deeper in many ways than perhaps if he were white. So I never want to give up on the mainstream news media. There are always, you know, good examples one can find within it. But, of course, independent media, alternative media are important. I think that the example I would use as one of the best is a website called blackcommentator.com. Mm-hmm. Blackcommentator.com, it was started by Peter Gamble and Glenn Ford, two longtime journalists with experience in both radio and television and print. Just a wealth of experience. We were lucky to have Glenn Ford speak here at UT last year, gave an amazing presentation about the role of the black media in black politics. And blackcommentator.com it's not a high-volume website. It's not being visited, you know, like the CNN site, obviously. But it is being read by important, I think, people within the black community as well as many of the rest of us. And we can see the value of that kind of critical journalism if we go to a site like that. Lots of, you know, places one can go to find journalism outside of the white dominant institutions.
Bob Jensen, we've come to the end of our hour, I'm afraid to say. The band is tuning up in the background. We've got to clear out of the studio for Tavis Smiley. I want to thank you very much for joining us today on Media Matters. And please come back again when your next book's out. What will that be, like 3 months from now?
No, I was actually trying to think a bit between books. There's some stuff in the works. But and then thank you for the show you keep doing and for all the work you do there.
Well, thanks a lot, Bob. We'll be in touch. And I'm Bob McChesney here at Media Matters. I'll be back in 167 hours. I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer, for the great work. See you in a week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and isolated thunderstorms, the high in the lower 80s with south winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-60s and south winds around 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny with the high in the upper 80s and light winds becoming south around 10 miles per hour in the afternoon. This is WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. 580 on your AM dial and on the internet at WILL.UIUC.EDU. It's 2 p.m. The Tavis Smiley Show is next.